Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Many of us have had moments when we're expected to speak up and we just can't get the words out. It is serious. We try to avoid that happening between 3 and 4. But when it does happen, people's palms can get sweaty, your mouth dries up, you feel your chest tightening, and panic sets in. And for people whose livelihood depend on flawless performance, this kind of panic attack can be devastating, or at least feel that way.
And that was the case for ABC News anchor and Newton native Dan Harris. 10 years ago on ABC's Good Morning America, when he had a panic attack live on the air. As he writes in his new book, 5 million people saw me lose my mind.
But that panic attack led Harris into what he calls a strange little odyssey to manage his anxieties and overcome addiction. It involved a disgraced pastor, a mysterious self-help guru, the nexus of neuroscience and spirituality, and finally meditation.
Dan Harris was a local Boston-based reporter for New England Cable News. He's now the co-anchor of ABC's Nightline and the weekend editions of Good Morning America. His new book is called 10% Happier: How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works, A True Story. And Dan Harris, thanks for coming in, and congratulations on the book, and it's great to meet you.
Thank you. I'm realizing that's such a long subtitle I've given you to read. I apologize.
It's a mouthful, but it says a lot, and there's a lot in there to talk about. So I want to begin, if I could, with a clip, and that is of this famous because you've written about it now, this on-air panic attack from 2004, and we've got a brief clip to play, but why don't you set it up for us?
Okay, so it's 2004. I'm doing a job that I'd done many times before, which is to anchor the news updates on Good Morning America, and they toss it over to me, the two anchors, Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer, and as you're about to hear, I just lock up.
All right, let's listen.
Health news now. One of the world's most commonly prescribed medications may be providing a big bonus. Researchers report people who take cholesterol-lowering drugs called statins for at least 5 years may also lower their risk for cancer. But it's too early to prescribe statins slowly for cancer production. That does it for news. We're going to go back now to Robin and Charlie.
All right, there's really some strained breathing there, and you had to bail out early, right?
So, yes, I was 3 stories into a 6-story newscast, and I did something I'd never done before, which is I just quit in the middle because I simply couldn't breathe. Mm. My heart was racing, my palms were sweating, and my lungs had seized up. I just could not breathe. I couldn't go any further, and I was in this cycle of self-reinforcing panic.
Mm. So I'm just curious about so much. I mean, what was the response to that when you came off the air? I mean, what did your bosses say?
Everybody was concerned for me. Charlie Gibson bolted out of his chair and ran over to see if I was okay. The producers were in my earpiece buzzing, and lots of people from the floor of the set were asking me, are you okay? And I lied and told everybody, I have no idea what just happened. It's a momentary glitch. It's not a big deal. But I knew that I had a panic attack.
Panic attack. And so what happened? Tell us where you go next with this. What explained the panic attack?
So I think the root of it really was something that a lot of your listeners will be able to identify with. It was its desire to be great at my job. And I got to ABC News when I was 28 years old. I left a job in Boston and went to New York, and I was working with all these giants like Peter Jennings and Diane Sawyer, and I looked like I was barely post-pubescent. I was incredibly green, and I was insecure about it, and the way I dealt with that was to be a workaholic. And I threw myself into the job, and after 9/11, I volunteered and spent many years overseas covering wars. And when I came home from that, I sort of crashed and burned and made a really dumb decision. I got depressed. And I was having trouble getting out of bed, and I self-medicated with recreational drugs. And even though I wasn't doing it when I was on the air or when I was working, my doctor later told me after the panic attack that it raises the level of adrenaline in your brain and primed me to have that panic attack.
Mm. You know, you wrote something really interesting early in the book. You said, and this sort of gets to one of the challenges of the job that you do, and you said the great blessing of being a journalist is that you get to witness world events. The great curse, though, is that, as I'd learned on 9/11, you come to see these events, at least in part, through the lens of self-interest. Did I get to go? Did I perform well? So it sounds like a lot of concern about competition, about performance that led to this, right?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. If you have a competitive job, it's hard not to look around and measure yourself against the people you're competing against. But you know what? I think it's true also for anybody in any phase of life, in any a part of society. I think you probably see it in mommy groups as well. It is the nature of the human mind to compare yourself against those around you. But I think it gets thrown into even more stark relief in a job like TV news.
So eventually, Peter Jennings, the late news anchor from ABC, assigns you to the religion beat, which helps propel you on this really interesting path of sort of self-discovery. But what was your initial reaction about being placed on the religion beat?
I didn't want to do it. You know, I grew up here in Newton, and my parents are doctors at Harvard, secular scientists, and I was raised, I had a bar mitzvah, but there was no real religious
one of those
content.
Secular bar mitzvahs.
Yes, yeah,
right,
it was for the money, basically, and and for the social acceptance. It really was not at all a sectarian practice. Mm-hmm. And so I was not interested at all. I told him I didn't want to do it. He said, shut up, kid, you're going to do it. And it was an eye-opener for me because to meet all of these people, who many of whom became my good friends, who had a view of the world that transcended self-interest was very much what primed me to go even further on this, as your colleague said, strange little journey.
It's really interesting because you end up interviewing big thinkers like Deepak Chopra, Eckhart Tolle. Eventually, you end up signing up for a 10-day meditation retreat. What was your initial attitude about all of this stuff, this world of sort of touchy-feely spirituality?
When I was 5 years old, my parents sent me to a yoga class for kids at Anger Elementary School in Waubun, which is part of Newton. And the teacher did not like the fact that I was wearing jeans, and she made me strip down to my tighty-whities and do sun salutations in front of all of the other children. And from that point on, I hated hippies, anything having to do with the New Age, or anything touchy-feely. So my attitude about meditation was this is going to be uniquely ridiculous, uniquely uncomfortable, and it probably involves robes, you know, moving into a yurt or collecting crystals or whatever. And I thought it was not for me. But it turns out there's an enormous amount of science that says it can be great for you, and that's what really changed my mind.
Well, there's speaking of sort of initial feeling that this isn't for you, I wonder if you could just read. Do you have your book there?
Yes, I do.
This is on page 130. Describing the second day, there's just a little bit about the sort of internal dialogue you're going through in the second day of this meditation retreat.
Sure, and I'll set this up just slightly by saying, so I after my initial reluctance, I really got pretty deep into meditation, and I was overcome by this fever to go further with it and to tell people about it because I realized it's got a huge PR problem. It's not what people think. It's just a simple brain exercise, and it can be transformative. It's not going to fix all of your problems. But anyway, so here I am, day two of this retreat, and I say, I find it humiliating, infuriating, really, that after a year of daily meditation, I cannot get a toehold here. Every instance of mental wandering is met with a tornadic blast of self-flagellation. In. I'm trying to feel my breathing here. Out. I wonder if they'll have more of that fresh bread at dinner. Damn, dude. In. Did someone actually invent and patent the sneeze guard or, like math and language, was it devised in several disconnected civilizations more or less simultaneously? Idiot. Incompetent. Irretrievably, irrevocably, irredeemably stupid.
Sounds like, in that moment, your head is a pretty scary place to be. But this resonates so well. I've tried meditation. I know a lot of people will identify with this. That chatter in your brain. How do you stop it?
That's our life.
Yeah.
People, this was a powerful observation for me. The racing mind, that is your life. We walk around in a daydream, in a fog of fantasy about the future and memory of the past. Most of our life. Very little of it is spent in the present, for lack of a less cliched term. And in meditation, you are doing battle with this voice in your head, and you are seeing it for what it is. And so I try to write about it in all of its wonderful ridiculousness.
You say you became a reluctant convert to meditation. Mm-hmm. I'd love to ask you a little bit more about the reluctance. Does it go back to this early experience in Waubun with the hippie meditation practitioners that you didn't like?
Yeah, I mean, there's something about, you know, first of all, meditation has this PR problem because it was brought to this country by robed gurus, hippies, and beat poets. But I think though there are many wonderful meditation teachers in America right now, most of this stuff is presented as if there's like a pan flute accompaniment, mm-hmm. as if it's being read to you out of a fortune cookie. And it's just been my hope that it can be talked about with some irony and with some humor and honesty in a self-deprecating way.
It's you write about it really well and really clearly. This is from the ABC News website earlier this year when you were actually writing about your journey and about this book. You say meditation is a tool for taming the voice in your head. You know, the voice I'm talking about. It's what has us constantly ruminating on the past, projecting into the future. It prods us to increasingly check our email, lurch over the fridge when we're not hungry, lose our temper when it's not in our best interest. That's a great description.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, we may not be aware that this is going on, but when you're unaware that the voice, the inner narrator that is the central feature of your life, that is your sense of self, when you're unaware of it, it yanks you around. Mm. And meditation is a great way to defang that.
Well, you went into it, you've gone into it deeply. I understand you practice regularly every day. Now, how has it helped you? Has it, first of all, reduced those panic attacks?
Yeah, well, the panic attacks went away when I stopped being a moron and using drugs. Mm-hmm. What it has done is allow me to navigate an extremely competitive environment without being yanked around by my emotions. I'm also much better at focusing on what I have to do in any given moment in an age of multitasking. That I caught myself walking down the hallway the other day with a glass of water hanging out of my mouth, simultaneously typing on my BlackBerry. So I'm not a monk, but I'm much better at being able to stay on task. And also when I'm being stressed out at work, I don't let it kind of get into my mind stream in an unconscious way and then go home and take it out on my wife.
Well, to what extent does the world you work in, this hyper-competitive, competitive and demanding work of daily network news, to what extent is that incompatible with the sort of goal of a quiet mind?
I love this question. Do you ever see Rocky III?
Yes.
Okay, so Rocky III, Rocky Balboa starts out. He's on a winning streak. He's the champion of the world, and Mr. T's in the audience, glaring at him, and Mr. T's hungry and is going to beat the crap out of Rocky, who's gotten fat and complacent. Yeah. And that is the worry of every successful person. Every time I go to a meditation seminar, somebody gets up and asks the same question, which is, if I do this, is it going to make me ineffective at work?
Yeah.
And people, there is this deeply held cultural assumption that somehow happiness and achievement or happiness and creativity are incompatible. I think clearing out the mental chatter makes you much better at what you do.
Hmm.
And I think it makes you go soft in a not in the pejorative, but in a way that makes you more supple and able to see clearly how things are and adjust, as opposed to trying to bulldoze your way through immovable objects.
It's interesting, and I take your point, and I think you're right. In my gut, I think you're right. But sometimes, having been 25, 30 years in the world of journalism, I worry about this. I mean, there is a competitive, not so much cutthroat in the world that I work in, but it's competitive, it's pushy, and I find it hard to balance this idea of remaining compassionate and thoughtful, but keeping your sort of professional edge, and, it does seem like a tricky balance.
But it's not one or the other. It's mm-hmm. one and the other in a balance that is tricky. It's like in spin class, they say set the dial, if anybody's ever been to spin class, the teacher will say, set the dial to 5, but there are no numbers on the dial, so you have to set it for yourself. I think there is a way in which you can be nicer, calmer, but still be stressed. And I think one of the problems with modern meditation teachers is they underplay the value of what I call constructive anguish. I believe in stress, but there's a point at which stress and worry is no longer useful, and it's great to have a tool to figure out when you've reached that point. Mm-hmm. And diminishing returns are reality.
Tell me about this again on that ABC website you wrote. Even though telling this story makes me uncomfortable, I've decided it's worth the risk. Why did it make you uncomfortable?
Because I didn't get into, I'm on TV, so I clearly have something of an ego, but I didn't get in the business necessarily to talk about myself.
Right.
I don't have a long history of doing that. And so it's uncomfortable to talk about myself, and these stories are embarrassing. I'm very candid in the book, not only about the drug use, but also about the type of crazy worrying I did in response to my competitive job. And I wrote it in isolation, mostly, you know, sitting around my home in my computer. So to have it released to the world, it makes me uncomfortable. But I was overcome, I would say, by a kind of fever when I discovered meditation to tell people about it. Mm. And so even though it is embarrassing, I'm willing to do it because I think there's some small chance that maybe it could push this practice further into the mainstream.
Yeah. And what's the biggest sort of misconception, misunderstanding that a lot of people who don't meditate need to be disabused of?
I would say in your audience, I'm just making some assumptions about people who listen, I think probably your listeners may be more predisposed to give it a try, but the biggest misconception that I would guess your audience has is that it's too hard for them specifically. I hear people say to me all the time, I know meditation is great, but I could never do it because you don't understand. My mind moves too fast. My mind is crazy. Mm. Welcome to the human condition. newsflash, you are not special. That is the way all of our minds work. Meditation is hard. If you're doing it right, so is exercise. Getting on a treadmill should be difficult unless you're cheating. And that's what meditation is, a daily set of bicep curls for your brain. It's not going to regrow your hair or help you win the lottery, but I think it will make you 10% happier.
I was just going to read that. That's your sort of penultimate line in the story, your penultimate line. It is not going to do all that stuff, but it will make you 10% happier or maybe much more.
And I had a friend, a meditation friend, say to me recently, 10% happier is fine, but it's more or less accurate, but what you've left out is that it's compounding interest annually. So I do think that it's 10% that does double down for you like your IRA.
Just to bring this back home to Boston, you conclude by saying there used to be a sign on the wall of Newbury Comics, my favorite record store in Boston. Wasn't it all of our favorites?
Mm-hmm.
Above the list of upcoming releases, it read, "All dates can change, so can you."
I love that sign.
Nice
I love
sign.
That sign.
Nice way to end the book. Nice way to end this conversation. Dan Harris, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Dan Harris, ABC newsman, co-host of Nightline. He's author of 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works, A True Story. I'm Anthony Brooks. Stay with us. There's a lot more coming up with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.